Well, today is our last normal message in our series on Psalms with their backstories. And we have to just have to. These are three wonderful Psalms. We have to say something about these, even though we are sort of speculating on their backstories. Sometimes we know exactly when a Psalm was written, say, you know, in the course of David's life. But some Psalms, we just don't know when they were written for sure. But we have to take our best guess on some of these. And so today, we're going to be looking at Psalm 66, Psalm 100, and Psalm 123. And they're both, all three are so wonderful that we just can't pass them up. Now, we think that these Psalms are coming from the days when the captives returned from Babylon and in the 500s B.C. And they're going back to Jerusalem. They've been set free, and now they have to rebuild Jerusalem and rebuild the temple and get their worship started again. We think that's the backstory to these three Psalms. Psalm 66, we think this is the backstory because it says in verse 11, you brought us into the net, you laid affliction upon our loins, and then you see that that's sort of like, you know, captivity talk, and now we're free. You brought us out into a wealthy place. So captives brought back home, celebration. Same thing with Psalm 100. We think that this is a return from captivity psalm, and we have an idea that this is the case because there's a great note of Thanksgiving. This is like the quintessential Thanksgiving psalm. If we're going to preach a psalm on Thanksgiving Day, you know, this is what we do. So this is a Thanksgiving psalm. Everything has been improved. Everything has been changed. Enter into his courts with thanksgiving, into his gates. And remember that as soon as the captives came back to Jerusalem, first order of business, to get the altar set up so we can do our sacrifices again. And then right after that, we have Nehemiah rebuilding all the walls and the gates. You know, very, very important. And that's in the 100th Psalm. Now the 123rd Psalm. We think this is a return from captivity psalm because they have enemies all around them who are jeering and taunting and mocking them. And that sounds just like the days when Sanballat and Tobias and others were tormenting Nehemiah and the returned captives. And so we think that the 123rd Psalm is also from the same period of time. You'll notice that two of these that we're looking at today, Psalm 66 and Psalm 100, have the same verbiage when you start out the Psalm. The first one, Psalm 66:1, says, make a joyful noise unto the Lord, all lands. Like everybody, no matter if you're Jewish or not, everybody should make a joyful noise to the Lord. Same thing in the 100th Psalm. It opens up, verse 1, make a joyful noise unto the Lord, all lands. And we're not going to look at this Psalm, but the 98th Psalm also says make a joyful noise. And we think that's a return from captivity Psalm. But we're not going to talk about that one because we have our hands full with what we have. All right, so today, looking at these Psalms, follow this progression of thought. This is the way you're going to feel as we look at these three Psalms. Psalm 66 sort of has this mood. A very short time ago, we were so beaten down. But you, Lord, when we had no way to help ourselves, while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. That's the idea, right? When we had no way to help ourselves, you brought us into a wonderful place. So we were in captivity, and now you brought us back home. Thank you, Lord, for that. Then when we come to the 100th Psalm, it's all going to be, thank you, you know, enter into his courts with thanksgiving, into his gates with thanksgiving, into his courts with praise. So we thank you with all our hearts. You made all this joy possible. And then in the 123rd Psalm, it's, but please give us new mercies, Lord, because we have enemies all around us mocking us while we're trying to do a really hard task. So we need you freshly even now. All right, here's what the 66th Psalm sounds like, and you'll pay special close attention to the words that are in yellow font. Make a joyful noise unto God, all lands. Sing forth the honor of his name. Make his praise glorious. Say unto God, how frightful you are in your works. Through the greatness of your power, your enemies shall submit themselves to you. All the earth shall worship you and shall sing unto you. They shall sing to your name, Selah. Think about that. Come and see the works of God. He is frightful in his actions toward the children of men. He turned the sea into dry land, Exodus, right? They went through the flood on foot. There we rejoiced in him. He rules by his power forever. His eyes observe the nations. We were just in captivity in those nations. His eyes observe the nations. Do not let the rebellious exalt themselves. Selah. Think about that. Oh, bless our God, you people, and make the voice of His praise to be heard, who holds our soul in life and does not allow our feet to be moved. For you, O God, have proved us. You've tried us as silver is tried. You brought us into the net in Babylon, and you laid affliction on our loins. We had to push and pull and pick up. You've caused men to ride over our heads. We went through fire and through water, but you brought us out into a wealthy place. I will go into your house with burnt offerings. I will pay my vows, which my lips have uttered and my mouth has spoken when I was in trouble. I will offer unto you burnt sacrifices of fatlings, incense of rams and bullocks and goats. Selah. Think about that. Come in here, all you who fear God, and I will declare what He has done for my soul. I cried unto Him with my mouth, and He was exalted with my tongue. If I regard iniquity in my heart, the Lord will not hear me. But God has indeed heard me. He has attended to the voice of my prayer. Blessed is God who has not turned away my prayer nor His mercy from me. Now, there are lots of great things in that psalm, but I especially want you to notice in yellow font here was in verse 12. You've caused men to ride over our heads. We were in captivity in Babylon, and we were in captivity because we lost the war. You've caused men to ride over our heads. We went through fire, and then we went through water, but you brought us out into a wealthy place. Wealthy meaning a prosperous place, a really good place. And, you know, that's so much like one of my favorite verses in the book of Isaiah, chapter 43, verse 2. Notice the water and the fire we've been through, right? When you pass through the waters, I'll be with you. And through the rivers, they shall not overflow you. When you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned, neither shall the flame ignite upon you. So you see the water and the fire. We went through water and we went through fire, and you brought us out into a wealthy place. The Lord brought us from captivity, and He brought us into a wealthy place. Now, there is an element of literalness to all of this, even though we could say, wow, you know, you've really been through some deep water when you've been through a hard time, or you've really gone through the fire when you've gone through a hard time. So we use that allegorically, you know, metaphorically. But there was some literalness to all of this as well. These are ancient sculptures showing chariots running over people. Remember what the text says, you've caused men to ride over our heads. When the Jewish people lost wars, they literally were trampled by horses and chariots, and they would never forget that. And so why did they go into Babylonian captivity? Because they were trampled on the battlefield. So you see, it's real. Beyond that, not only were they knocked down on the battlefield and trampled, we see we went through fire. Of course, that could be just metaphorical, but they really did. So many of the captives in those days were put to work, the Jewish captives put to work building the canals. So remember, what you call Babylon in Bible times, you call Iraq when you're watching the news today. And so, you know, that's a desert place. And so the only way Babylon could prosper was by channeling the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, particularly the Euphrates, through their town. And they did that with a series of canals. And the canals were made out of brick. And the brick was sealed with tar, bitumen. And so that's what the captives had to do. So you picture the Jewish people being hauled off into captivity in Babylon. And they have to construct canals out of brick. Well, you're going to need a ton of brick if you're going to run canals back and forth around the area of Babylon, the city, and surrounding areas. So we have these huge brick kilns. And you have to, you know, fire the brick like ceramic. You fire the brick to make it strong. And there are these huge furnaces. And who is manning these huge furnaces? A lot of Jewish people. That, again, is the backstory to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Why did Nebuchadnezzar have a furnace big enough to throw three men inside and they walk around? These are the huge brick kilns, and they're very dangerous. The heat is extraordinary, and nobody cares about you. You're a captive. If you burn up, we don't really care. So just go and get the bricks done. Make these huge ovens, and sometimes the ovens would fall apart. Sometimes the people would get burned with the hot bricks. We went through fire. Not only that, you had to seal the bricks in the canals with tar. So you have these huge cauldrons of boiling tar. And so the captive gets too close and he gets burned. We don't care, he's just a captive. Sometimes the gases from the tar ignite and explode. Oh, well, we lost a few Jewish people in the explosion. It doesn't matter, they're just captives anyway. We went through fire, the brick kilns, the cauldrons, and then they lived in thatch-roofed, inexpensive houses. And they cooked over an open fire under a thatch roof. And they heated their homes that way when it got cold in the desert nights. And sometimes the thatch roof would catch on fire. Well, your house catches on fire, catches the neighbor's house on fire, catches the neighbor's house on fire. And now you have entire Jewish settlements that have been burned out. We went through fire and we went through water. These rivers and canals that are keeping, you know, the Babylonian city and surrounding areas irrigated, these are built by Jewish people, and sometimes the Euphrates River and the canals are running swiftly, and not all Jewish people even knew how to swim, because after all, they were not raised around water. The Mediterranean Sea, yes. The fishermen, Sea of Galilee, yes. But mostly, these are land people. And you're working on the muddy banks of the canal. You slip in. The current takes you away. Oh, well, he's just a captive. He drowned. It doesn't really matter. Over and over and over again. You cause men to ride over our heads. We went through fire and we went through water and we saw all of this with all of our loved ones for 70 years. And then here we are. Those days are past. You brought us into a wealthy place. We're back home in Jerusalem. This is our farmland. We understand this land. You brought us back into a wealthy place. And that's a wonderful thing. Almost all of you will have times in your life where you really go through the fire. Now, I'm going to tell you about a rough 10 years in my life. And it is extraordinary how the Lord brings us through. So if you're in the water right now, or if you're in the fire, don't give up, right? So here's how it was for us. In 1985, I was 25 years old. Teresa was 23 years old. And we had our firstborn son. And he had to be born without health insurance because I was working on my seminary degree, a master's degree at that time. We didn't have much money and we didn't have insurance. So Josh came along without insurance. In 1987, I'm 27 years old. Teresa's 25 years old. Our second born son, Jed, is born without health insurance. And at that time, I'm working a construction job for minimum wage. So I have 7 years of education and I'm 27 years old and I'm working for minimum wage out in construction. In 1988, I was 28 years old. Teresa was 26 years old. And we borrowed money from my parents on two separate occasions because we couldn't pay for our rent. So I'm 28 years old and I have two children and I can't pay my rent. In 1989, I'm 29 years old. Teresa's 27 years old. And we had a miscarried baby. Teresa carried the baby for 5 months. We also sold our last substantial asset in the world. Even though this is 1989, I have a 1964 and a half vintage Mustang, which is in cherry condition, Arizona, no rust. And it's the last thing in the world we had worth anything at all. And we sold it so that we could do ministry. In 1990, we arrived in Virginia for ministry. And we had a net worth of $800 when we landed in Virginia. In 1991, I'm 31 years old. Teresa's 29 years old. Our third child is born without health insurance. And since we're objects of charity, all of the medical students gather around and watch Teresa. No dignity, no privacy. Here, have a baby with an audience. In 1992, I'm 32 years old. Teresa's 30 years old. And we tried to buy a house for $45,000 in the Ocean View area, which is a terrible neighborhood in those days. And we couldn't even qualify for a $45,000 house. In 1993, I'm 33 years old. Teresa's 31 years old. And we are installed here at Avalon. And of course, that's wonderful. But 1 year later, in 1994, I'm 34 years old. Teresa's 32 years old. And there was this sickening, I'm using the word sickening, church conflict, because I would go to a board meeting and there is Teresa at 32 years old going to bed because she has a queasy stomach because she knows these people hate me and it bothers her. In 1995, I'm 35 years old. Teresa's 33 years old. We have a net worth of $0, no bank accounts, living from paycheck to paycheck. We do have two used cars, so maybe we have some net worth. But that was a pretty rough 10 years. I think you can appreciate that, right? But now watch. You cause men to ride over our heads. We went through fire, we went through water, but you delivered us into a prosperous place. Now, this is delicate, you know, I guess you're not supposed to really talk about personal finances and everything, but let me just try to show you why I am sometimes astonished. So this is a map of our neighborhood, and on the left side you see an arrow at approximately, you know, 9 o'clock, and it says that there's a $400,000 house there that Teresa and I own free and clear, which is extraordinary. You know, like, how did that happen? You have to bear in mind that at no time did I ever make $100,000 a year, and usually it was about $60,000 a year. And there's one exception to that, and that's last year when we happened to sell a double duplex property. So last year we did make more than that. But that's the only time we've ever made $100,000. Normally we're way under that. So we have this house that's free and clear. The arrow that's just under the 9 o'clock arrow, that's another house. That's the house we live in right now. And that one's worth about $450,000. We own that about, you know, halfway. And so we own this house and the one across the street. Now, on the top of the map, we're pointing at another house. This is where Mark lives, and this is a $500,000 house. When he came here to Virginia, we had to find a way that I could help take care of him. And the Lord worked it out for me and Mark in our situation to buy a $500,000 house, which is crazy. So now we have three houses side by side in a neighborhood. And then on the right hand side, that's a new acquisition. My middle son, Jed, just now closed on that house last week. And that again is a $500,000 house. And because the Lord was good to us, we were able to give Jed and Lauren $200,000 to help them buy that house. Why is that possible? That the arithmetic should never work. We went through fire and we went through water, and you might say that sometimes we felt like we were being trampled on the battlefield. But the Lord brought us into a wealthy place. That's just extraordinary. There's no way that should have worked, and yet here we are. By the way, the reason that's important is because we have been able to help our kids and our grandkids. The family has banded together in one place, and it matters. And that was, you know, a lifelong dream. One more thing before we leave the 66th Psalm. Verse 17 says, I cried unto him with my mouth. If I regard iniquity in my heart, the Lord will not hear me. But the Lord has heard me. That's so important. If I regard iniquity in my heart, the Lord will not hear me. Your prayers are hindered by sin, and you don't want that to happen. And so the psalmist says, like, if I look in my heart and I see that I'm doing something wrong, I'm supposed to forgive, but I'm not going to. I'm supposed to be honest, but I'm not going to. I am supposed to be kind to that person, but I'm not going to be kind to that person. I just won't. If I regard iniquity in my heart, I see that it's there, and I just refuse to do anything about it, then the Lord will not answer my prayer. The Lord will not hear me. And this is a thing that we find not only in the Old Testament, but in the New Testament as well. And I'm not going to read you all of these verses, but if you look in the green font, notice it comes up over and over. James 5:16 says it's the prayer of a righteous man, not the one who regards iniquity in his heart. The righteous man that accomplishes a lot. Job says, now here's the hypocrite. Will God hear his cry? And the answer is no. God's not going to hear the cry of the hypocrite. In Psalm 18:41, they cried, but God didn't hear them. In Psalm 34:15, the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, but his face is against those who do evil. And by the way, that's in the New Testament as well. Proverbs 15:29, the Lord is far from the wicked, but he'll listen to the prayers of the righteous people. Again, Proverbs 28:9, the wicked person his prayer is like an abomination. God doesn't want to hear that. It's repulsive to God. Isaiah 1:15, they made many prayers, but the Lord said, I'm not going to hear those. Again, Jeremiah 11:11, I'm not going to listen to those prayers because they are evil. Jeremiah 14:11, I won't hear their cry. Zechariah 7:13, I wouldn't listen to them when they prayed. James 4:3, you ask wrongly, so I'm not going to give you that request. 1 Peter 3:7, again, treat your wives nicely so that your prayers aren't hindered. And one more time, 1 John 3:22, whatever we ask, we receive of Him because we keep His commandments and do the things that are pleasing to Him. When R.A. Torrey was talking to a woman one time, she said, I used to be a Christian, but I'm not a Christian anymore. He said, why is that? And she said, well, because I tried the promises of God and they don't work. For example, we find in the Bible that it says, whatever you ask believing, you shall receive. I tried. It didn't work. So R.A. Torrey read her 1 John 3:22. He says, whatever things we ask, we receive of Him because we keep His commandments and do those things that are pleasing in His sight. Now, ma'am, were you keeping His commandments and doing those things that are pleasing in His sight when you ask for something? She said, no. See, it's the righteous person's prayer that accomplishes much. And if I regard iniquity in my heart, the Lord will not hear me. Now the 100th Psalm. A short psalm, but so sweet, right? Make a joyful noise unto the Lord, all lands. Serve the Lord with gladness. Come before His presence with thanksgiving. Know that the Lord, He is God. It is He who has made us, and not we ourselves. We are His people and the sheep of His pasture. Enter into His gates with thanksgiving, into His courts with praise. Be thankful to Him and bless His name. For the Lord is good. His mercy endures forever, and His truth endures to all generations. You see in the yellow font there? His presence. See, we used to be in captivity, but now we can come into the gates because we rebuilt the gates. We can come to His courts, the courtyard where the altar is, because we rebuilt the altar. So let's do that. Let's all go and be in the presence of the Lord. And let's do it with thanksgiving. One of the most interesting insights I've ever seen on this is that it just might be that it is only when we are thankful that we ever really can enter into His presence. His warmest presence. If you don't feel thankful, there are probably layers of relationship, degrees of relationship and closeness with God that you will never enjoy. Only the thankful heart gets to really walk into His warmest presence. Our good friend Ann Voskamp is good on this topic, talking about the 100th Psalm and entering into the Lord's presence. My perspective is my key to enter His gates. I can only do so with thanksgiving. If I see God seeping up through all things, then can't I give thanks for anything? And if I can give thanks for the good things, the hard things, the absolute everything, I can enter the gates to glory. The practice of giving thanks is the way we practice living in the presence of God. As long as thanks is possible, then joy is always possible. If you can just go to the Lord with thanks, then you're going to enjoy His presence. Say, I won't do it with thanks. Then you might not enjoy His warmest presence. They're all intimately connected. After Don Piper's terrible accident, remember I referenced him a couple weeks ago, and he had a limb amputated, and he had actually died. He had no pulse for 90 minutes, and now he's back in the hospital. He has to be in the hospital for 105 days, and he was in great pain, and he talked about what it was like in those days. He said, I felt worthless, beaten down, and useless. You have caused men to ride over our heads. I feel beaten down, useless. I prayed for God to take me. I didn't want to live any longer. I prayed that way for days, and usually I'd fall asleep from exhaustion. When I'd awaken, a cloak of hopelessness would spread over me again, and nothing helped. But his wife brought him some recordings of Christian music, worshipful music, and he never really cared about them very much, like, yeah, you know, thanks. But then one day, something changed. I couldn't bear to watch another TV rerun, so I decided to play the cassettes. Something happened during those pre-dawn hours. The dam broke. I think the crying lasted about an hour. Calmness swept over me, and I lay relaxed and very much at peace. That's when I realized another miracle had taken place. My depression had lifted, vanished. As I listened to those songs, God had healed me. The despair lifted. My mental chains had broken. My attitude changed. I had no idea when my physical pain would end, but I knew Jesus was with me. I still didn't understand why God had sent me back to live with all this agony, but that no longer mattered. Now I was free. The Lord had healed my mind. See, praise, thanks. This is how we come into the Lord's warmest presence. And without praise and thanks, maybe we never sense that warmth. Notice one more thing before we leave this. So nice. The 100th Psalm says, well, you know, it is God who has made us and not we ourselves. And that's so beautiful. We are the sheep of His pasture. And how else really could we account for all of, in the first place, the lucky breaks that have come to us in life? God made these things happen. God made us and not we ourselves. God is the one who made us in the womb, right? And then God is the one who made all of our pleasures and successes and achievements possible. And God is the one who made all of our spiritual inclinations and all of our service possible. And without that, what would our lives be? How do we account for all the lucky breaks in life? And then, how do we account that very soon now, not many days, we are going to go to heaven because we've trusted in the Lord Jesus and His gospel? And we're going to live in happiness forever. How do you account for that except that the Lord has been so good to us? And then once we get to heaven, because we have served Him, there will be special favors and rewards and ranks. How do you account for that except the Lord, He made us and not we ourselves? We couldn't have done it ourselves. We didn't do it ourselves. 1 Corinthians 4:7 says, who makes you to differ from another? Why are you so athletic and the other guy isn't? Why are you born in America and the other guy isn't? Why are you kind of pretty and the other guy isn't? How is that possible? And the answer is, the Lord made us, not we ourselves. Who makes you to differ from another? And what do you have anyway that you haven't received? And if you've received it, why do you glory? Why do you radiate as if you did it yourself? It's not you. The Lord helped you at every juncture. Then we have to say something about the 123rd Psalm. Now, Lord, we have to look to you again. You brought us into a wealthy place, and we're just going to thank you forever. But now we have to look to you again because we need new mercies. There are people all around us. There are situations around us that are breaking us down. We need you to give us daily bread. We need you to help us again. So, verse 1. Unto you I lift up my eyes, O you who reside in the heavens. Behold, as the eyes of servants, and notice this in yellow font, as the eyes of servants look to the hand of their masters, and as the eyes of a female servant unto the hand of her mistress, so our eyes wait upon the Lord our God until He has mercy on us. Have mercy on us, O Lord. Have mercy upon us. For we are exceedingly filled with contempt. That is, people treat us with contempt, and we're just filled with it. Everybody hates us. Our soul is exceedingly filled with the scorning. That's the scoffing. People roll their eyes at us and mock us. Our soul is exceedingly filled with the scorning of those who are at ease, with the contempt of the proud. They treat us with contempt, and it's breaking us down. As the eyes of a female servant look to her mistress. Every servant, male or female, doesn't matter. Every servant really is dependent on others for everything. They have to get their food from others, their shelter from others, every mercy from others. That's the nature of being a servant. But a female servant, that's the part that really strikes me in this. A female servant has all the more need, is all the more dependent. Because a female servant can't farm as well. They're not quite as strong and hefty. They don't farm as well. And a female servant can't protect herself from the males around them as well. And we find that the female servants, when they have children, they don't have as much liberty to do whatever they want. They have to take care of the little ones in a special way. So for the female servants, they are really, really dependent. And this text says, just like a female servant looks to her mistress for food and shelter and mercy, that's the way we look at God. And all of us who are weak and without resources need the Lord's mercy. That's so great, right? Who do you look to? Now, when a doctor delivers your baby that was in fetal distress with a cesarean section, when it's all done, you thank the doctor for his good work. But who do you thank for the miracle of life in the first place? You can't thank the doctor for that. And who do you thank for the cosmic purpose that this little one has as a bearer of the image of God? You can't thank the doctor for that. Who do you thank for that? That's the Lord. Now, when a police officer restrains troublemakers so they don't hurt your children and your spouse and your loved ones, you go and you thank the police officer. But who are you supposed to thank for the 1,000 troublemakers who thought about menacing you and decided not to? There's no policeman around. Now you have to thank God. And when a pilot gently crash lands his airliner into the Hudson River, as actually happened in 2009, you can thank the pilot for his skills in easing that airplane into the icy waters of the Hudson River in January. But who are you going to thank that all 155 passengers survived and in only 24 minutes so they didn't get hypothermia? Who are you going to thank for that? Not the pilot. You have to thank God. And so we realize, as the eyes of a female servant look to her mistress for yet another mercy that never ends with us. Chuck Swindoll tells the story, it's a true story, of an airplane crash, and this coming from 1968, a plane that was going to land in New York. Descending to the destination, the pilot realized that the landing gear refused to engage. He tried the controls again and again to make the gear lock down into place. No success. The passengers were told to place their heads between their knees, grab their ankles just before impact, and the pilot announced over the intercom, "We are beginning our final descent into New York. At this moment, in accord with the international aviation codes established at Geneva, it is my obligation to inform you that if you believe in God, you should commence prayer." The plane landed on its belly. No one was injured. Next day, a family member called the airlines and asked the pilot, "What is that rule?" He said, "No comment. There's no such rule." But who do you thank when you crash land a plane and you're not hurt? You can't thank the pilot. You can't thank the mechanic. You're going to have to thank God. It is He who has made us and not we ourselves. We are like servants looking to the hand of our mistress for yet another mercy. So here's our conclusion. From Psalm 66, "Very short time ago, we were so beaten down. People ran over our heads. They trampled us. We went through water. We went through fire. And you brought us into a wealthy place." That's so wonderful, Lord. And from the 100th Psalm, "We'll never forget that. We'll thank you with all of our hearts because you made all these joys that we experience today. You made all these possible. And we will enter into your gates with thanksgiving and into your courts with praise." And from the 123rd Psalm, "Lord, one more time. We have to look to you again. We're like female servants looking to the hand of their mistress for yet another mercy. Mercy because the task before us is just way too big and we're kind of breaking down again here. And there are people, invisible enemies, grinning at us as we struggle. Lord, please give us another mercy. We look to you." And that is the last of our Psalm series, except next week where we recap all the favorite things in Psalms.